My first guest of the evening is our astronomer, Alan Gilmore, who is not atop Mount John in the Mackenzie country, looking down on Mount Tekapo and up at those beautiful, clear Mackenzie country skies. No, he's just down the road from me in Wellington. Kia ora, Alan. Welcome back to Nights.
Kia ora, Brian.
You timed your visit to Wellington perfectly. Did you hear that meteor? Did you see it?
Unfortunately, no. We were right downtown at the time in the noisy traffic. So we might have heard a rumble, but if we did, I think I gave you a rumble at one stage, but I assumed it was an aeroplane, and in fact, it probably was. We think we were probably in a bookshop or somewhere.
Yeah, what that time. Well, I was out in the garden, and the noise came in the direction of the airport, and I at first thought, oh, that's a plane, but I did think at the same time, that's an odd-sounding plane, because it was not the steady roar that you get from a jet plane taking off at Wellington Airport. It was broken, and it was deeper. It sort of came and went. And that made me think, oh, I hope it's not a plane blowing up, which it wasn't. And then I wondered whether it was an earthquake, because I thought for a moment I felt a little bit of vibration, but then I thought if it's making that amount of noise, it can't be a quake. Things would be shaking more than that. It was only when I came to work, however, that I did wonder maybe it was a volcanic eruption, like the Hungahunga Hapai Tonga volcanic eruption back at the start of the year, something really distant, but it turned out to be a meteor. And it must have been a pretty large one to make that amount of noise, Alan.
Yes, indeed. I wouldn't hazard a guess, but I think Ian Griffin from Otago Museum, who knows quite a bit about this, he was on the radio earlier suggesting that it was probably about a metre across, and that strikes me as being a pretty good guess. It may be from the brightness, if we can get more pictures that can be analysed, and it's not impossible that there were vibrations on the ground that seismographs might have picked up. That happened with the a meteor that crossed the North Island. Interestingly, on the same date, back, I'm not sure, about 10 or more years ago, and that did actually produce vibrations on the ground that were helpful in trying to analyse the amount of energy that came from it. So it was obviously quite a big object. How much of it actually got to the ground is something we can't, or to the sea, depending on where it came down, is something I don't think we can answer with the information we've got so far.
Do we know in what direction it was travelling yet, Alan?
Well, the pictures I've seen, the dash cam pictures and so on, it looks like it's coming more or less straight down. It's very quick. But you'd need to get pictures from sort of various directions, so that the more dash cam and security cam, whatever pictures that people can find from different locations, the better it would be to triangulate the actual flight.
When you mean straight down, you mean straight 90 degree down heading towards planet Earth?
Yeah, that's right. And I think supporting that was the brevity of it. It was extremely quick. You just see it appear in the camera, it brightens up, and then suddenly it has an extraordinary flare, and then it's basically a little bit of a trail again, and it's gone. I think it probably had a fairly vertical trajectory.
The sound lasted for what I thought was at least half a minute, quite a while, enough for me to have several goes at interpreting what I was hearing.
Yeah, that I think is. I don't know too much about this, but I think that is quite consistent, because in the same way that lightning, you get a rumble, a long rumble from a lightning flash, and that's because the sound, the lightning hits the air up all the way back up to the cloud, and you first of all get the sound from the part of the spark that was near you, and then you hear the sound coming from further and further away up the lightning strike. And I think the same thing happens with this, that the sound made by the lower end of the trail is what you get first, and then you hear the sound that's been made by more distant things. We had a good number of years ago, a fireball come down over Christchurch. This was well before the earthquakes. And not many people saw the thing in the sky. It was just a smoke trail. It wasn't anything like as bright as this. But the shockwave hit Christchurch, caused everything to jump. And quite a lot of people reported hearing, after the bang, the initial shockwave, they could hear a sort of rumble noise that did go on for some time. So it's possible, if you were indeed hearing the meteor, that you were hearing sound that was coming from further up the track of the meteor.
Jake from Ekerahuna sent through a text. We heard thunder and felt a series of vibrations through the ground just north of Ekerahuna Township. Had assumed it was the army doing an ammo disposal.
Yep, in fact, if that's the case, then quite likely the seismograph network would have information that can be combined with other information to get the amount of energy coming from it, and that in turn takes us back to how big the object actually was. So there's quite a lot of work to be done. I'm not quite sure who the central authority for doing that work is now, but there's obviously lots of observations from optical like cameras and things, and seismograph networks and so on, that could determine how big the object was. To have heard it at all, it has to be below 60 kilometres up.
Why is that?
That's because of temperature layers in the atmosphere. And if the sound is generated above 60 kilometres, the temperature layering in the atmosphere causes the sound to get refracted, to get bent back upwards, so it doesn't reach the ground. So if you hear a meteor, a rumble or a boom, then that's that shows that the meteor has come lower than 60 kilometres.
And for it to get that low, how big does it have to be? Is there a consistent rule of thumb in terms of that?
No, I don't think so.
Okay.
I'm no expert on this. It would depend on how fast it was travelling through the atmosphere, partly, and probably on the trajectory too. There was the meteor, I think it's called the Glendale meteor, that came down over Auckland a good number of years ago and came through a house roof. Nobody actually saw that falling. There was no flash of light or anything like that. It was just a stone that suddenly punched through this house
really?
Roof. Yep. And but that one, it wasn't even particularly blackened by the flight. So it would depend on the speed.
Why, given that, Alan, how can we be even certain that it was a meteor if its landing was so relatively gentle and unassuming?
Oh, well, different trajectories will have different results. The speed that a meteor comes into the atmosphere, a rocky-type meteor, they originate from the asteroid belt in the first place. And so they're going around the sun in the same direction as the Earth. But after that, it depends on the exact nature of the orbit, the speed that it encounters the Earth. So some of them can be coming in at relatively low speeds, when we say relatively low, sort of 15 kilometres a second, up to about 30, I think, is probably about the maximum that you would get for a piece of rock coming from the asteroid belt. So they can have that sort of difference. And also, it probably, though I'm struggling a bit here, depends on the direction that it hits the Earth from, too, how much of the Earth speed is added to the object as well.
I got a text here from Damien which reads, I was in the garage in Miramar when there was some rumbling and shaking. I thought it was an earthquake, so I went to the doorway, but realised it was something else when I heard what sounded like distant fireworks, similar to the Tonga eruption, which I also heard, but faster. My best guess was it was gas bottles exploding maybe at a factory on fire. I only realised it was a meteor when I heard Jesse Mulligan talking about it while driving to pick up the kids from school.
Right.
Somebody else is wondering, can we be certain it's not space junk?
Well, I don't know whether we can be completely certain, but space junk usually comes in on a very low trajectory. The object has been, most of these objects are orbiting the Earth, and so they come down, they're still sort of in Earth orbit, and so they enter the atmosphere relatively gently. So we've had several reports over the years of a sort of meteor that goes right across the sky, leaving smoke behind it, and those have turned out to be re-entering orbiting objects. So I think it's unlikely, not impossible, but you could have orbits of some particular objects that are extremely elongated orbits that perhaps could do that. But I think that's very unlikely from my limited knowledge of this topic. So I think it's almost certain to be a meteor-type object.
Now, I'm pretty sure, Alan, that one of the eye or ear witnesses to this event, I think it might have been a mayor or deputy mayor in the wider upper district, talked about a buzzing noise. And I think we've talked about buzzing before, but buzzing that they hear when they see it. Now, that seems very odd, because you don't hear lightning unless you're right next to it at the same time you see it. There's a great distance. Why or how could you possibly hear a buzzing when you're seeing a flash way above you?
Yeah, this has been a great puzzle for a long time. There are many reports over the years of people seeing very bright fireballs and hearing them at the same time. And these were largely dismissed as, oh, people are sort of kind of manufacturing the sound. But the clincher was, I think, about 20 or more years ago, three astronomers were walking across a university campus somewhere and heard a buzzing coming from behind them, turned around, and it was a brilliant fireball. And it's called electrophonic sound. There were various theories over the years. Colin Kay, who was a meteor expert who started off at Canterbury University and went to the University of Newcastle, he had a theory that maybe the ion trail, that is the gases get ionized, they get electrons stripped off them by the meteor going through the atmosphere. And you can bounce radar off that. And in fact, Wellington radar seems to have recorded a trail, which is probably the ionized trail. Colin Kay suggested that was also mixing, upsetting the local magnetic field, and that people were, that somehow this was feeding into hair and things like that and causing vibrations. However, the best recent theory, and it's backed up by calculations, comes from, I think, Stanford University. High-speed cameras have found that what looks like a sort of extreme brightening is, in fact, a whole series of very brilliant short flashes. The dash cam pictures you saw, might have seen on the news, they just showed a sort of a rapid brightening and then a fading again. But within that brightening, if you've got a high-speed camera, there are lots of brilliant flashes. And the heat from those is enough to warm up hair to the point where air around it expands away. And this is going on at hundreds of times a second. And that produces the buzzing noise. So it's
in our ears. Yeah. Is it the hairs in our ears?
Oh, not the hair. No, because they wouldn't be exposed to the infrared, to the heat radiation. It would be hair around your head and hair in, well, if you were wearing a woolly hat or something like that. It had been noticed, and Colin Kay actually recorded this. He studied a fireball that came down over Sydney back in the early 1970s, I think, or the 1970s. And what he noticed, there was two people who reported, who were standing together, who saw it. One heard it and one didn't. And the one that saw it was, she had particularly frizzy hair. And so this kind of fits rather nicely with this Stanford University model that proposes that it's heat very rapidly oscillating, flashing, flickering heat radiation coming off the fireball that produces the buzzing noise.
Alan, if it's heat radiation, why don't we feel it? Why don't we feel the warmth?
Well, probably because it's so brief, it's only enough to warm up very fine fibres sufficiently. So you may not feel it because it's very, very much a flickering sort of light or heat. But yeah, I'm sorry, I don't have the background information to answer that one.
I've got a text from somebody who wants to know, where can I get updates on this meteor? Well, I guess there's not many updates in terms of its progress. I assume it's either landed or broken up and burnt up. But what's the best site to go to, Alan, for information?
I don't...
Where would you go?
I'm struggling, actually. I just went to the standard news media sites and saw the things there. We used to have a sort of national observatory at the Carter Observatory, but that doesn't exist anymore. Professor Bagley at Canterbury University is retired. He probably will collect reports. The Jenny McCormick in Auckland also collects reports. Ian Griffin will be interested at Otago University, at Otago Museum, and there's Duncan Steele, who's with the space, whatever the space agency is now called. Duncan knows a lot about these things too. So, but none of these people, I think, would have a website that maintained updates at this stage. So I'm a bit at a loss to come up with any kind of central place that's got the information. It's very scattered at this stage.
Yes, well, here's some more scattered accounts. Kids in my class today in Levin came running in at lunchtime to tell me, and I'm a teacher, they saw a strange light in the sky. Well, I could have seen it too if I wasn't a Downton Thomas. Well, there you go. Believe your kids, teacher, believe them. And this came through. I was at the peak of Mount Albert in Wairarapa, which I think is not too far from the wonderful Wairarapa Mount Bruce Bird Sanctuary around Ekitahuna. 650-odd metres up, working on a VHR radio site. From the south, heard a low rumbling, crackling, popping for a time, followed by a loud sonic boom. Very odd, and thankfully was with another person, so I knew I wasn't imagining it.
Right, yes.
It's fascinating how different the accounts are depending on where you are, but very widespread, aren't they?
Oh, yes. Well, plainly there was a lot of energy released by this, and you could see that in the dash cam pictures. You could see the thing coming down, and then suddenly there was this extraordinary flare, which obviously overloaded all the camera receivers. So it was exceedingly bright for just a second or two as it was coming, when it flared. Yeah. Mm. So a lot of energy in it, and therefore a lot of noise. So it must have come well below the 60 kilometres for everybody to be hearing so much noise from it.
Now, Alan, I should ask you about some of the things you actually wanted to talk about.
Well, this is fun.
You've been so good talking about this stuff off the cuff. But I did want a couple of things. One was a new map of the Milky Way, I assume in 3D, because there's no such thing as a two-dimensional galaxy.
Yeah, well, this is the latest from Gaia. Gaia is a satellite. It's not going around the Earth. It's out at what we call the L2, the L2 point, which is about 1.5 million kilometres outside the Earth's orbit, and it goes along with the Earth, just as the James Webb Space Telescope. It's parked out there too. They don't just sit there, they kind of orbit what we call the L2 point. And Gaia has been up there since about 2013, and it's measuring the positions of stars, 2 billion stars, to an extraordinary accuracy, just a few millionths of a second of arc. Now, if you look at the moon in the sky, the moon is half a degree across. That's about 1,800 seconds of arc across. And Gaia is measuring positions of stars to a few millionths of a second of arc. If you think of the moon again, if you had a sort of something about 8 centimeters across on the moon, Gaia would be able to distinguish that tiny angle. Now, that doesn't mean it's seeing detail to that point, because it's kind of averaging the position of a star as it sweeps across it.
Hang on, Alan, did I hear you right? Did you say 8 centimeters?
8 centimeters.
8 centimeters.
Yes, the angle at 8 centimeters on the moon would subtend from the Earth. Gaia can measure to in the best cases.
That's extraordinary.
Yes, oh, it is extraordinary. It's measuring to millionths of a second of arc. But as I was qualifying, it doesn't see detail to that point. It's averaging the position of a star as it sweeps across its very, very large detector. It's got an enormous kind of digital camera thing called a CCD, which is about a meter square. And anyway, it's now this latest release, which was last month, is the positions of 2 billion stars in our galaxy, and I think also in the Magellanic Clouds, and that's two nearby galaxies. But not only just measuring the positions, because they've got the observations now over several years, it's measuring very precisely how these stars are moving across our line of sight. But also it's got other equipment for spectroscopy, so it can measure how fast the stars are coming towards us or going away from us, what we call the radial velocity. So we get the three sort of dimensions of position in space from Gaia, because it can measure the distance of these objects as well. That's done by what we call the parallax. As the Earth goes around the Sun, we look at stars from very slightly different angles, and we can see the stars sort of shift to and fro as we orbit the Sun. So that's called the parallax. So that gives us the distance. Then you've got the proper motion, as it's called, the movement of the star through space across our line of sight. And then it's got the spectroscopy to give the speed towards us or away from us. And so we can get the star's distance and its movement in three dimensions, but also it can it can analyze the light of the stars and get the chemical composition of stars, not perhaps all 2 billion, but a large number of them. It's produced the spectroscopy for several million stars. And it's also able to pick up the way it's working, the wobble of a star if it's got a dark companion going around it. Now, we know of lots of several thousand now stars that have got planets orbiting them, but they haven't been detected by the radial velocity change, that is, the wobble of the star towards us or away from us as it's going around the center of mass with a planet. Or we see the star dim very slightly if a planet goes in front of it. But if we've got a planet that's distant from a star, current technology wasn't able to pick it up. But now Gaia can see the star sort of circling around the center of gravity with a distant planet as well. So it provides yet another way of finding planets around other stars. So there's an enormous amount of information that's coming out of this one satellite.
I'm speaking to Alan Gilmore, our astronomer. He's normally at the Mount John Observatory above Lake Tekapo in the Mackenzie country. He's in Wellington at the moment. Sadly, not quite in the studio, but he's not too far off. Alan, I was thinking, because last night was a beautiful clear night as I rode home on the bike in the middle of the night, and the stars were very clear, and the moon had gone. And I was just thinking of the fact that when I look up at that constellation, I was looking straight south to the Southern Cross. I think, how long has it been pretty much in that shape? And the fact that we're moving at such speeds through space just reminded me of how vast space is, that those stars, which aren't actually that far from us in terms of how many stars there are in the Milky Way, have remained in that kind of shape for how many years, Alan?
A very long time, many, many, many thousands of years. If you go back 10,000 years, then the Southern Cross would look pretty much as it looked now, because three of the stars in the Southern Cross, the first, second, and fourth brightest stars in the Southern Cross are all about 700 light years away. The star at the head of the cross is about 90 light years away. It's an orange-colored star if you look at it in a dark sky or look at it with binoculars. And it's a bit closer. So it's kind of moving down on the Southern Cross. So 10,000 years ago, the Southern Cross looked rather more kite-shaped than it does now. And in 10,000 years hence, the head star, if you like, will be squashing the thing down further. The star to watch, though, if you could live for centuries, would be Alpha Centauri, the brighter of the two pointers. It's moving more or less towards the Southern Cross, a bit above the Southern Cross, and it's moving at about 3 seconds of arc a year, which means in 600 years it would move about one full moon diameter. So in 10,000 years' time, Alpha Centauri, the brighter pointer, will be somewhat over the top of the Southern Cross. Beta Centauri, the other pointer, is again very distant, 700 light years, well, distant as naked eye stars go. It's about 700 light years away, like the stars of the Southern Cross. And in fact, it's part of a kind of family we call the Scorpio Centaurus Association. And they, over thousands of years, don't perceptibly move. So close by stars do move quite fast in terms of centuries. And distant stars retain the constellation part that's made of distant stars stays roughly the same.
In 10,000 years, how far have we moved around the centre of the Milky Way, our solar system, roughly?
Not much at all. We take, now what's the figure? I think we take about 200 million years to do one orbit of the galaxy. I think that's the right figure. We're moving around the galaxy at, I think, 300 kilometers per second, I think is the speed. This is off the top of my head, so I won't...
300 kilometers a second.
You can
it's pretty quick. I mean, it's nowhere near the speed of light, but it's quite a bit faster than any Saturn rocket can go.
Indeed, yes. But it still takes us about 200 million years to do one orbit of the galaxy.
And that reminds me of another thing you wanted to talk about, and that's the Voyager spacecraft, which are the two spacecraft which have travelled furthest from Earth. Am I right?
That's right. Yep.
And where are they now?
They're getting out. They were launched about 40 years ago, and they're about. What was the figure? About 19 billion kilometres from the sun now. That's about four times as far away as Pluto is, or four and a half times Neptune's distance. So light or radio, well, it's radio we talk to them with, takes about 17 and a half hours to travel out to them.
Okay.
And their reply takes that long to come back. So
19 billion kilometres, but in terms of a light year... It's not even a light day yet, let alone a light year.
That's right. Yeah, 17 and a half hours. As you say, it's not even a light day at this stage. So the nearest star is four and a third light years away. So space is awfully big, yeah.
Are we still picking up, are they still sending any signal back to Earth that we're picking up on?
Yes, they have. They crossed it's been very interesting to follow. They crossed the boundary between the sort of the solar wind, the gas that's coming out from the sun, into what we call interstellar space, where they're sort of in the very thin gases between the stars. Several years ago now, and that was very interesting for astronomers. But they are powered by plutonium. Power supplies, they've got this plutonium, which is heating up a little generator thing, which is providing the power. But the plutonium is now running down after all this time, and so they're having to power down various bits of the spacecraft so they can just keep it going, so it can still radio back some information. It's only got a very large parabolic sort of bowl to... send the radio signals back, but the radio transmitter is only, I think, something like 26 watts, comparable with the sort of light you've got in a refrigerator, and yet they're still picking up the signal when it's 19 billion kilometers from the sun, which just shows how amazing the technology is that they're using them, these things.
What would the sun look like from that distance? Would it be as bright as, say, Venus's?
Oh, much, much brighter. Mm.
So it still could be a fair bit brighter, even that at that distance.
Oh, yes. I've seen erroneous sort of comments that, you know, the sun from Pluto would be only as bright as the full moon. Well, that's not true at all. The sun would be vastly, vastly brighter than the full moon. And, it's at 19 billion, oh, golly, I need to do the sums. Well, four and a half times Neptune's distance, that must be 15 times Earth's distance from the sun, which would mean that the sun's brightness is, what's the square of 15? That's something like 225 or something. It would be very much brighter still than the full moon.
Alan, thanks so much for joining us again. Thanks for your time. Have a lovely time in Wellington, and we look forward to speaking to you again when you're back at Lake Tekapo.
Thanks, Ron.
That's Alan Gilmore, our astronomer. A bit of an extended session there, but, you know, you don't get a meteor hear a meteor on your garden every day. So you got to talk about that kind of stuff when you get the chance.